Welcome back to the Broken Middle Podcast. I'm your host, Pastor Kurt Poland. Today is October 31st, 2020. The 2020 election is just 4 days away. It's Reformation Day today. And it's funny to have a Reformation Day like this just days before what's going to be a hugely reformative day in the United States, one way or another. Reformation Day, of course, historically comes from Martin Luther tacking his 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church. But Reformation Day has endured as a church holiday, not just because of Luther, but because it's come to embody the spirit of what happens when Christians decide that they're going to take the witness of Jesus Christ seriously, seriously enough to let it reform their own lives. When we go looking for witnesses to this kind of reformation today, they can sometimes seem few and far between. But just a few generations ago, there was a witness to this kind of Christian faith whose work and whose legacy continue to speak volumes even in the church today. That person, of course, is the Lutheran pastor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer is the author of many books, beloved to Christians on both the theological left and right, books like Life Together and The Cost of Discipleship. Indeed, many of you listening might have a story about how you picked up Bonhoeffer for the first time. To commemorate Reformation Day, and to try to have an important Christian conversation before this consequential election, the guests on the podcast today are Dr. Jennifer McBride, the president of the Bonhoeffer Society, and Dr. Christopher Norris, visiting professor of public theology at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., and the author of a new book that takes an in-depth look at Bonhoeffer's legacy, in particular, how Bonhoeffer's attitude toward race and racial justice developed across his life as a Christian and across his theological career. Regular Broken Middle podcast listeners will know that I try to keep these podcasts to about 45 minutes apiece. Well, the conversation with Jenny and Chris got so interesting that it went longer than that. At first, I tried to cut the podcast down to 45 minutes, but found that with each edit, I was taking something essential out of our conversation. My next try was to try to go ahead and post the podcast in the fullness of its length and just encourage you to listen to it and maybe take breaks. But our platform right now doesn't allow us to upload such big media files. So I've elected instead to break the podcast in two. This is section one. In this section, we'll cover the major details of Bonhoeffer's life, and we'll look at how his attitude toward race changed as he got involved with Abyssinian Baptist Church in downtown Harlem in New York. In section two, we'll turn to our present time, and we'll ask the question, how might this situation that we're in right now, with all its conflict, look a little bit different if we have Bonhoeffer next to us, thinking alongside of us, teaching us, and also showing us how to learn from his mistakes? I hope you'll stick around and listen to both sections. Now, on with the podcast. So Chris, Jenny, welcome to the Broken Middle Podcast.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So let's start with a basic question. Who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and why are we still reading him?
Bonhoeffer is someone who I think has really captured a lot of the of American theological and church imagination because he has such an interesting story. I mean, he was a theologian and a pastor and a seminary instructor in Germany, you know, during the rise of the Third Reich and his resistance to the kind of to Hitler and to the Nazi regime. His theological and political resistance has really made him someone who Americans are fascinated by. He was born in 1906, finished his PhD, his dissertations in theology in 1928, And then he came over to America and studied with Reinhold Niebuhr at Union Theological Seminary, spent a year at Union. And during that time, he began attending Abyssinian Baptist Church. And so was kind of immersed in the life of the African-American church context here, which really changed his theology from one. If you kind of read his first couple books, they're pretty dense and abstract theological texts, and he credits coming to America and being immersed in that Black experience with turning his theology, what he says, from the phraseological to the real, where he attends to the concrete and begins looking, seeing theology emerge from below, from the perspective of the marginalized. And so then he returns to Germany in 1931, just as the kind of Nazis are beginning to gain some political power, and is able to immediately see the threat of Hitler after he takes power in 1933. And I think 2 days after Hitler, takes the, gains office, he goes on the radio and talks about some of the problems that are there kind of immediately. And then begins teaching in an underground seminary when as the Nazis sort of take over the German church. He joins a kind of church resistance movement called the Confessing Church that's trying to resist some of the Nazification of the German church, and begins a seminary training pastors in this Confessing Church movement. Eventually that gets shut down, and he continues to kind of work with these seminarians as he begins a sort of underground operation in the German resistance movement, and actually kind of becomes associated with people who are plotting to assassinate and overthrow Hitler. Eventually those plans are found, and he's eventually arrested and put in a concentration camp and eventually executed right in 1945, right before Germany falls.
Wow. Chris, you said something that really caught my ear about Bonhoeffer's experience with Abyssinian Baptist Church, and the language you used was he brought about a transition in his life and in his theological writing from the phraseological to the real. Can you say just a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, up until that point, Bonhoeffer's written a lot of books, and these are books that are very popular, especially one that we kind of popularly understand as The Cost of Discipleship and Life Together are probably his two most famous ones. And they were written after this time when he was in America. His first couple books are these dense theological treatises on the church and on theology and philosophy. And so, the kind of German Theological Academy at the time was very concerned with these sort of abstract concepts, and he even, Bonhoeffer served as a pastor before then, but was still sort of in this kind of abstract world. And when he comes to America and begins teaching Sunday school at this Black Baptist church in Harlem, he begins to see the kind of the suffering and the oppression that's going on. He takes a trip with one of his seminary friends into the American South and sees kind of Jim Crow and segregation and the effects of that. And that changes him to be able to kind of attend to the ways theology arises from the lived community rather than from up top. And so he begins in a letter that he writes later in Germany, he talks about seeing theology from the perspective of the marginalized, from below, from the outcast and the oppressed. And so this time that he spends in Harlem, which kind of really shifts the way the sources that he uses, attending to the marginalized voices as the sources of theology.
Fascinating. Jenny, I'd love to hear from you now. Why are we still reading Bonhoeffer? Why has his life, his legacy, and his writings captured so many hearts and minds?
Yeah, well, Chris mentioned two of those sort of more popular books, Life Together and Cost of Discipleship. Nachfolgeut, translated into English, is The Cost of Discipleship, that sort of famous phrase now. And that's how I got interested in Bonhoeffer. It was after college, and I was a part of something called a fellows program, that was sort of a program through an Episcopal church up in Washington, D.C. And my internship was at a place called the Southeast White House that was sort of called itself House of Hospitality. It was in a predominantly poor Black neighborhood and was concerned with connecting people across difference. And I sat around a table with other folks that are part of this ministry in the kitchen table, sitting like reading life together for the first time. And I think that what draws, you know, my background, like yours, Kurt, and like Chris's, is I come out of conservative evangelicalism. And of course, the focus so much is on Jesus and relationship with Jesus, which is still a very important part of my faith today. But Bonhoeffer, you know, the central piece of his theology, the core of it, is Christology, which of course just a fancy word for saying the study of Jesus Christ, who is Christ, and what is Christ's work in the world. And so Bonhoeffer's language felt really familiar in a way that felt safe, and yet he was saying things in a nuanced way that was sort of matching my own intuitions and longing for a new way to articulate the faith. So I think that that's really, I think for people who are really wanting to dive into Bonhoeffer's theology, that's often the first way in, and it's a fine way in. I think that the other piece is, you know, it is interesting that he's probably, you know, the only 20th century German theologian that is somewhat of a household name, you know, for American Christians. And I think that a large part of that is the story that Chris just told. I mean, you can imagine it on, you know, a Hollywood film about it. It's interesting to think of this, you know, pastor, professor, who becomes involved in a resistance plot against Hitler. And so his story is really fascinating. But I think that is where we can often go wrong with Bonhoeffer, is that he is someone who, I think this is true of Jesus, I think this is true of Martin Luther King Jr., he's someone that Christians on very you know, opposite sides of the political spectrum can sort of claim as their own. And I think that one piece of that is, if I can be so blunt and say that I think that a lot of Americans really are drawn to stories of violence, and we misinterpret, we think that Bonhoeffer was sort of condoning this violent plot against Hitler, and that's not really what was happening. And so when you do the really hard work of starting to read this German philosophical theologian who wrote 10,000 pages across the course of his young life, he died at age 39. It takes a lot of work to kind of, and a lot of reading to see what he's getting at. It's worth it, but it takes a lot of work. And you get a different picture than from just sort of hearing a brief version of the story of his life.
It's really interesting what you say, that he has this Hollywood appeal, that's part of why we take an interest in him. And it's funny, you mentioned Life Together and The Cost of Discipleship, which I think even to this day, besides the Charles Marsh biography, Chris, which you helped to edit thoroughgoingly, I think those are the only works of Bonhoeffer that I've read more than once, and read in the context of sort of unfolding ministry and discerning my own vocation. And so, Jenny, when it comes to Life Together and The Cost of Discipleship, say we start with those two. Where might the inquiring Christian who's trying to discern her own call, her own sense of what she believes, where might she go after that if she wants to continue getting to know Dietrich Bonhoeffer a little bit better?
Oh, this is such a hard question. I get asked this all the time. I would not necessarily say that the best way in is through Life Together and Cost of Discipleship. It's a fine way in. I think, you know, I wish there was a simple entry point that could sort of give an overview of Bonhoeffer's theology. But the reality is that he was writing. He's a systematic thinker, but he was writing in these fragmentary ways. And so even books like Ethics, you know, is we don't have his finalized, you know, draft ready to go off to the publisher. We have bits and pieces, and scholars have had to put it together, you know, figure out what the right ordering was. So, but actually those, let me just say this one point and get back to your question, that those fragmentary pieces is actually what makes Bonhoeffer such an interesting thinker to think alongside with out of our own context, because he has these fragmentary sort of flashes of light that we can kind of figure out what they mean across his corpus, and then sort of keep thinking within the logic of his thinking, but out of our own context. But to answer your question more directly, I'll just say that I think I've recently reread and done really for the first time a really close reading of his book Creation of Fall, which comes out of Lectures from 1932, and it's he calls it a theological reading, I guess, of Genesis 1-3. I think you can see the seeds of a lot of his main theological themes are kind of born there. So I'll just say briefly one thing that I've been thinking a lot about that comes out of that text is he talks about our creatureliness as human beings. And what it means to be a creature is that we are not to be like God. And our creatureliness means that we are interdependent. It means that we have limits. It means that we're to respect the limits of other people. And I think that in my own scholarship, and as I, you know, I know we'll move into sort of interpreting this moment, but, you know, I think that this is a really key piece, is that I think that Christians assume that we're supposed to be like God. It's a religious goal. We're supposed to become like God. And Bonhoeffer says, no, we are supposed to be the creatures we were created to be. It's beautiful to be a creature. You know, he has these lines in Creation and Fall that says, you are a creature, go and be a creature. And then that language gets taken on in Ethics as this celebration of the human being, because God became human. It's that God loves human beings. You are to be a human being. You are not to try to grow beyond your humanity. So I think that, and again, you know, I mean, Creation and Fall, it's not the easiest read either. And what you really have to do is read across his text and kind of start to sort of see where there's these themes that keep creeping up and, you know, in different moments over the course of his writing life.
So it's on the one hand, you have Bonhoeffer here really trying to reclaim the goodness of creation, which we can, I think, especially those of us who have some experience with the evangelical church and the evangelical world, the emphasis on our need of salvation and sometimes of Christ's sort of yet to come, Christ, like the future of the second coming, the futureness of that, and our removal from that, can sometimes our emphasis on those two things, which are part of Christian faith, can nevertheless obscure a foundational and basic confidence in the goodness of creation, in the goodness of being a creature, in the goodness of being a human being, like you're saying.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then I thought something else that you said was interesting, and I hadn't quite thought about it in this way before, but the actual texts that Bonhoeffer left behind were not actual texts. They were fragments of texts that later editors came and put together as best they could. And in that regard, I mean, not unlike the writings of Paul, part of reading Bonhoeffer is kind of reconstructing him or even constructing him. I mean, we have to put the puzzle together as we're trying to read and interpret it. It kind of sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, at least half the work is just trying to understand. This is true with many philosophical theologians, just trying to understand what they're actually saying. In the case of Bonhoeffer, you know, I think that there's so much in his language that's captivating. You know, there's a poetry sometimes to the language, not all the time, but I think to the texts that we're really drawn to still today, it's because I think the beauty of the language opens up our imagination, our theological imaginations in new ways. But yeah, I do just want to just say to your point about the goodness of creation, that was really, you know, it was the focus on Jesus that made me comfortable with Bonhoeffer, but it was his proclamation of, you know, he calls it the this-worldliness of Christian faith, and that this call to love life as it is in this world, in this messy world. And he really gave me permission as a conservative evangelical who was really taught to, you know, that the world is fallen, that, you know, that there's, we're to be suspicious, that, you know, the point of Christian faith is that we are going to die and go to heaven. And that's really what all this is about. And, you know, Bonhoeffer says no, and says no based on his understanding and reading of the Bible, that it's about the kingdom of God coming to earth. And so, so it's really important, I think, that we recapture the goodness of creation, the this-worldliness of Christian faith. And another related point is that Bonhoeffer says, following Paul, you know, that the world is already reconciled to God, that is its constitution. And so it's not just that we can love this fallen world, we love the world that is now reconciled to God. That is its character, it's its ontology. It's the very being of reality, is that this world is now reconciled to God.
So that's the perfect leaping off point. This world is now reconciled to God. Reconciliation is something that I think we are all longing for right now in this particular moment, this cultural moment in the United States and the wider world, this political moment where we are deeply divided and falling victim to the nature of the business model of social media, which makes money by driving our outrage. And we're not reconciled when it comes to race relations in this country in particular. And there's a suspicion of talk and of calls for reconciliation, because there's concern on the part of people who have been historically marginalized in this country that a premature reconciliation will come at the cost of justice. So Chris, if we can turn to you, because you've done a lot of work now on Bonhoeffer and race. You mentioned that his experience with Abyssinian Baptist Church and getting to know a community of African Americans and traveling to the South and seeing Jim Crow really changed how he thought about God, how he thought about Jesus, and how he thought about God's work in the world and God's call on Christians. What can Bonhoeffer's life and legacy teach us about race, and maybe teach the white church in particular about race and how to think about this particular moment in those terms?
Yeah, it may seem odd to turn to this, you know, mid 20th century white European German figure to as a source for how to think about racial justice in America today, you know. but you know, much has been written about his kind of life-changing immersion in the Black community and Black church in America, and then immediately going back you know, to Germany to kind of confront and resist this racist political regime and racist church movement that was you know, kind of erupting in response to that. And so I do think that Bonhoeffer offers us some important lessons for what it can mean to be for looking at the kind of the racism that's intrinsic to the white church in America. I think that he offers someone who's trying to make this conversion to what James Cone, you know, founder of Black Liberation Theology, calls white people to become Black. And I think Bonhoeffer is someone who attempts that journey, but is also instructive for us in the ways that he sort of stumbles and falls short of that also. And so, so when Bonhoeffer has this experience and you know, his theology changes to look to the marginalized, to the oppressed as the source of and kind of grounding of theology, and he goes back to Germany and you know, immediately after Hitler comes to power, the kind of German church adopts the Arian law, saying that, you know, people of Jewish descent can no longer be church leaders, can no longer be baptized in the church, and kind of adopts the racist language of the political culture that's around. And Bonhoeffer resists that, but it's important to see that to not be too hagiographic about that, and realize that he does this first because he's worried about religious freedom. He doesn't want the government to have control over the church. It's not immediately his concern about the oppression of the Jews in Germany, but more to maintain some freedom of the church. And it's only when the German Christian movement, which is the Nazification of the church, when they adopt these Arian laws and exclude Jews from church membership, that they make race such a central and gospel issue that he says, okay, now this is important enough that we need to begin to resist it. And he begins kind of forming this confessing church movement. So at the same time that he's looking to and pointing us to these marginalized voices and saying, we need to listen to people who have historically been on the edges, the outsiders, the outcasts, and allow them to inform us and tells us as white Christians in the white church in America today to maybe stop, listening to expand the canon of who we turn to and look to black theologians and black pastors and womanist theologians and people sort of outside of who we've typically looked at for how to read the Bible, how to interpret the Bible. He's also someone who tells us that this is going to be a long and a stumbling journey. We're going to make mistakes. Bonhoeffer kind of returns to Germany and embodies the same sort of colorblind racism that I think we see a lot of times in America today. Race isn't something that's kind of central to the gospel. Racism isn't a theological problem until other people make it one, and then Bonhoeffer finally comes around. And so I think that's instructive for us to see. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to need to have our eyes opened, but it is in turning to these marginalized voices that we can begin to kind of uncover our own blindnesses to this.
Chris, does Bonhoeffer have a readership in black theological discourse that you've come across?
Somewhat. So I've done a lot of research on James Cone, founder of Black Liberation Theology, and it was instructive to me to see that as Cone kind of writes over his 50-year career with a relentless criticism of white theology and the white church, criticizing some of our most revered theologians like Walter Rauschenbusch and Reinhold Niebuhr and Karl Barth. Bonhoeffer is the only theologian that he consistently writes about in a constructive and positive way. And I think it's because of both Bonhoeffer's experience, in Harlem and his kind of resistance to the racism of the Nazi regime and Nazi church in Germany. One of Jenny's colleagues at McCormick Seminary, Reggie Williams, has written a book called Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus that talks about some of the impact that Bonhoeffer's time in Harlem had and how Bonhoeffer kind of offers us a sense of a path to think about how to confront racial justice, racial injustice in America.
This concludes part one of the podcast with Dr. McBride and Dr. Norris. You can find the second part posted just underneath wherever you found this one. See you back in just a moment.